Joining us on the WBGO Journal is internationally renowned spiritual messenger and author, Teresa St. Francis, who is from Elmwood Park, New Jersey. So you didn't have far to come today.
No, right? I didn't.
It was great to see you.
It was great for having me here. Thank you.
So this is not something I'm used to doing. First of all, we don't talk a lot about spirituality on the WBGO Journal, but you have touched upon a subject that has really, had a major impact on so many people and their lives, and that is teenage suicide, which is a major problem right now.
It's a silent epidemic that society and a lot of powers that be don't want to discuss. They want to push it under the carpet, and it's a lot, I understand, because it's fear and anxiety, and a lot of it is just people want to stick their head in the sand and say, it's never going to be my child.
Now, I understand from looking at statistics from various organizations, it was actually on the decline for a while, but now is skyrocketing.
It's been skyrocketing for the last 5 years, and it's exponentially skyrocketing. It's not small numbers.
Why do you think that is? Before we get into your book and the people that you've talked to, why do you think that is?
I think there's a lot of factors that go into this that equate to children not feeling grounded, not feeling wanted or centered or connected. I think a lot of it has to do with society and social media and the peer pressure, parent pressure, competition. A lot of it also has to do with the fragmented family dynamic that we live in society today. And the family themselves, even if they're a cohesive family, the pressure of after-school activities, the lack of dinner, the lack of community within the family, and then lack of community within the community. And schools themselves, I don't really feel they have a handle on how to address this in a proactive way.
Do we have courses about teenage suicide in high schools and even younger?
We do. They're working on putting courses together. They're working on putting peer groups together. So in my book, I talk about one of the key components into being preemptive in this process is to put peers together with grouping. So somebody who's an adolescent who's attempting to commit suicide or has suicidal ideation will be more inclined to tell someone in their peer group than they will an adult. So that's really a key component to also putting a spotlight on preventive measures and issues.
At the age of 4, you knew you had some special abilities, huh?
Yeah, I did. I didn't know what they really were. I thought everybody had them, but I was able to see spirit from a very young age. People in my family that had passed, because I come from a very large Italian family, and my first love was my grandfather's dog, and Sheba was so special, and she and I connected like nothing I've ever been connected to at that time. And my grandfather passes, and she comes to stay with me, and she just speaks to me for weeks, grieving.
Now, as a spiritual messenger and the author of What Happens the Day After, Messages from Adolescent Suicides, you have been on the scene for a long time. So, you know, a lot of people will be skeptical about, you know, when it comes to spiritual messengers and whatnot. And I'm sure you know many people who are frauds.
Yes, I do.
And so that really hurts your cause at times.
It really does. It really casts a very wide shadow on my industry, because there are a lot of people claiming to be able to do what I know I can do. That's why I have public events where I pick people out of the audience, ask them to stand up and say their name, and I deliver messages from the other side in a public venue so that people can witness it for themselves and have their own experience. And a lot of people from that will come in for a private reading. I also do house parties in the tri-state area. I also do private readings. So I've been on the scene for a very long time and participating in with helping families deal with adolescent suicides.
People really want to know about the other side, don't they?
People really want to know about the other side. They want hope. They want faith that there is another side. People want to know that their loved ones are watching, that they're there. And in the book, I address that in many different aspects, including signs, how loved ones communicate with us from the afterlife, and including our spiritual tag team, teachers, angels, and guides, which is my Enneagram, we all have a spiritual family that have been assigned to us.
Numbers are a big part of spirituality, right?
Yes, they are. Numbers, consecutive numbers like 111, 222, 333, that usually means in a very broad platform that as above is below, or as above is below, meaning what's in going on in heaven is going on earth, or what's going on earth is going on in heaven. So there's a synchronicity with those numbers.
Now, throughout the book, you mentioned that there are times you actually need rest to because it's draining. So tell us a little bit about life as a spiritual messenger. You're getting these messages, you know, whether people believe in you or not, right? You're telling us you get messages sent from everybody all over the place, spirits all over the place, all the time. How do you just handle that?
It's difficult at times. There's nights I don't sleep because my house is Grand Central Station. Part of my job privately is to help those who've passed over who didn't realize they passed. So they will contact my tag team, and my tag team will wake me up or not let me sleep, and I will have dialogue with those lost spirits, helping them move to the light, as well as doing private readings. I do connect with those loved ones, but they go home with you. But because I am a healer as well, Spirit winds up interacting with me on a very daily basis to help with different aspects of afterlife. And it's a very complex process. So for me, there is not a lot of downtime. There's not a lot of quiet time. And when it's quiet, I enjoy just sitting by myself. The constant conversations that go on in my house and the activity is as heightened as Grand Central Station at rush hour.
So in your book that came out a few years ago, What Happens the Day After, you talk to people who have committed suicide, teenagers, and have come back and tell you why they did it. You went through similar circumstances as a young child and thoughts. Can you tell us a little bit about that painful past of yours?
You know, it was very difficult. Growing up with these gifts, there were no role models. There was nobody to clear what was going on in my life or make sense of it. So I would often see spirit. I'd often hear spirit. I often get information with people I know and don't know. Even when I'm out shopping or I'm out running errands, I do get messages for those who are I come in contact with or I pass, but it's not my job to interrupt them. So with that being said, it was a very difficult adolescent time for me because I didn't feel like I fit in. I didn't really fit into my family. I really didn't fit in to society. I didn't know where I fit in. And having this deluge of constant interaction with spirit, with nobody giving me any guidance, knowing me, teaching me how to manage it, it was overwhelming. So I did try to commit suicide a few times. I ran the car off the road and I hit a large tree and went down in a ditch twice, actually, once in college and once in high school. And I walked away with minor scratches. And people, rescue, fire, ambulance, car was totaled both times. They looked at me like, where were you in this vehicle? Because I really should not have walked out with a scratch on my head and a scratch on my knee.
So you really believe your purpose is to help others?
Yes, my purpose, because I've looked at my life contract, and I talk about that in the book as well. What our purpose is, why we're here, why we choose our family, our friends, our life lessons, our difficulties and challenges, as well as our successes. My purpose is to help those heal and understand that we are all interconnected and there's a far greater purpose than just what we see in front of us.
Many of the victims that you talk to in your book would have gone on to do great things had they not committed suicide. But are there people who are destined to do terrible things?
That's a great question. And the answer to that is yes. There are people who are destined because there's karma. And when we come back into this life, sometimes we have to balance out the karma or pay the debt. Or we've chosen to be that negative person to facilitate a change. Unfortunately, mankind, as a general rule, doesn't like to change. And the only time change happens is when something very bad or drastic happens.
So you're doing a reading or you're doing a public show, and the person who comes to you from the other side has a very negative or dark story to tell. Do you still pass that along to people who are really dying to hear something positive from their relatives or somebody that they cared about?
With every bad situation or negative, there's always a silver lining. There's always something to be learned. There's always something to accomplish in a negative environment. Let's do the most horrific thing that we as a country have grappled with, which was 9/11. And yet, when you look at pictures from that time during those days, you can actually see angels in the picture. You can actually see spirit interacting. And it is all over the internet. There was actually a picture of a New York City bus that had a lot of crumpled building on top of it. Somebody snapped a picture, and you can see a clear as day as an angel. So within negativity, within bad situations, something good does arise from it. It's the Phoenix Rising.
How many people have you talked to that were directly involved with 9/11? I would imagine quite a few.
Yeah, a lot. It's still something that people still come for readings in my office. And
people look for closure, but that's a tough one, right?
That's a tough one. It's not only closure, it's acceptance of a tragedy that is so hard to explain and so, I want to say difficult because of the visual aspects. We got to see it on TV. We get to see it and be recreated, whether it's TV, video, YouTube, social media. A lot of times those images still pop up, and that opens up old wounds.
We're speaking with Teresa of St. Francis, who is an internationally renowned spiritual messenger and author. Her book talks about teenage suicide, and she speaks with people who have passed on. Now, you say on page 164, what I'm saying is that we need to start changing the way we raise our children so that the foundation of how they view themselves and deal with life is strong and can withstand the external pressures. How do we do that?
We have to go back to basics. Basics in the way we raise our children. Like, for example, not every child who plays a sport should get a trophy. They have to understand and learn how to deal with no, how to deal with failure, how to deal with not being number one, how to deal with difficult situations so that they can see their own inner strengths and aspects of their own personality so they can grow. We have to give them the tools to, and the only way we give them the tools to deal with life's challenges is by letting them be challenged at an early age when the parents are around to be advisors, where they can be assisting, but they don't need to be interactive. I think also a lot of it needs to reside in the structure of the family. We've all heard the term helicopter parent. That helicopter parent needs to back off and let their child grow, learn full on their face. Let them pick themselves up. I think all too often families, parents, society want to pick children up and do it for them instead of letting them do it for themselves. That's another aspect. Another aspect is also social media. That needs to be really curtailed. When the later generations have grown up, like people from my generation, slightly younger generations, we grew up playing outside. We grew up in an interactive environment without parents, without adults supervising. So we as children had to figure it out amongst our children. So we learned how to behave, what was socially acceptable, who we were, how to have a voice. All these aspects these children don't have today because they are not afforded the opportunity to have that time to find out about themselves.
So should there be rules about access to social media when you're bringing your kids up? Is there an age? Some people say they shouldn't have their own phones for a long time. Everybody has a different opinion. What's your opinion on that?
Because I'm not only a spiritual medium, I was a pre-vet major, so I have a lot of medical background. Adolescent minds don't mature until they're 20 to 25. So they're still developing. So the social media, not only from a behavior spectrum, also from a chronological spectrum, from a cranial spectrum, these children are being conditioned by the social media, by these handheld devices, to react in a non-confrontational, non-interactive way, which means they can say and do anything they want without repercussion. And that repercussion is what they're lacking. So, yes, I think there should be a curtailed, at least till they're a teenager. Let some of the brain develop without the influences of technology. And if you've watched any of the CNN or news talk shows, these designers have come on and said that they actually design a lot of the social media to grab children's attention. So it's a form of brainwashing. I know that's an extreme word. People don't want to hear it. They don't want to associate social media with brainwashing. But when you continually do the same thing over and over, day after day, and you're bombarded with the same vibration, the same coding, your brain gets accustomed to it. It's a form of brainwashing.
The people that you have spoken to have all talked about issues that have really been predominant in the past couple of years. Those who've been bullied deal with gender issues, abuse, sexuality decisions. So these are things that are on the mind of teenagers all the time. It doesn't seem like it's getting any better, Teresa.
It's not. And that's my hope, to start having an integral process of dealing with suicide. You know, even as far back as 10 years ago, and I'm going to use cancer as the example. Even 10 years ago, I'm a survivor of breast cancer. And during my treatment, they were just starting to announce integral processes in the treatment of cancer, like spirituality, yoga, meditation, holistic other opportunities to help deal with the cancer side effects, to deal with cancer itself. We need to take the integral approach and apply it to suicide. It needs to be more than just pills. It needs to be more than just take this course or go through this behavior modification. It needs to be an integral process of bringing in the soul's identity, means each individual's child's identity, and letting them find their own self-worth, letting them find their own identity. Where are their strengths? What are their weaknesses? That self-awareness needs to be the forefront of how we deal with adolescent suicide. I really, in talking to these children, adolescents, teenagers, I find they have no self-awareness, no self-identity. They're so busy projecting outward, they forgot to go inward.
Does Teresa St. Francis get the respect you feel you deserve when it comes to, you have a strong message about this, about teen suicide and what we can do to help? Are enough people reaching out to you and say, hey, we want you to be part of our team?
No. Because of being a medium. And
does that frustrate you?
Very much so. Because there was a time, and I'm going to use cancer as the example again, when cancer was not being addressed from multiple platforms in an integrated process. Today, if you go to the major cancer centers, they have a spirituality department. They have a wellness department. They have a yoga department, a meditation department. They have interconnected aspects of not only traditional medicine, holistic medicine, and spirituality. We need to apply that to suicide as well, because that whole process will allow the child to move from the suicide ideation into a place of understanding and acceptance for themselves, and to find their life path so that they can walk the journey of life.
Usually when we see mediums in shows or movies, they're helping somebody solve a crime. Have people reached out? I know you mentioned that you dealt with an NYPD detective at one point. Have there been many times that you've helped police find information?
I have on occasion. Over the years, I've been doing this for over 35 years, so I've been asked a lot over the 35 years.
Do you always say yes or no?
I talk to my tag team, Teachers, Angels, and Guides, and we discuss what they want me to do. I don't make a move without their approval, because I am their charge. Their job is to keep me safe and guide me as I go through helping people, and not every situation really requires me to be interactive for whatever reason. I have turned down certain requests for different reasons.
You know that even as I look at you, you're someone who kind of, you scare me a little bit, right?
No, I didn't know that.
Well, you do, because I'm afraid of some of the things that you might say if I really did have a reading. So how somebody who, it's not, to me, it's not being a skeptic. To me, it's being, I don't know if I want to know. How many people do you deal with like that?
I deal with a lot of people that I don't know if I want to know. But the information I deliver is to improve the quality of your life. It's to improve your life lessons so that you understand yourself better, your life contract, your purpose here. My job is to make your life the life that you want to live and the life that you want to love. So if I'm going to tell you something that's concerning or that might be negative, I'm going to follow it up with the positive. Here's how you deal with that. Here's what you need to do. Here's the game plan. I give you the keys to the kingdom. So that if you come to a reading with me and we outline certain things in your life that you're having difficulty with or being challenged with, I provide a solution. Whether you take that solution or not through spirit, that's up to you. It's free will. And everybody has free will.
Yeah, you mentioned that a lot in the book, that free will is a major thing, and even in the life beyond.
Absolutely. Without free will, we would be nothing. That's the biggest gift the Creator gave us, is the ability to make our own choices, have our own freedom, but also the consequences to those choices are the way we learn our lessons.
It's been a few years now since What Happens the Day After messages from adolescent suicides. How has it changed you?
Wow, that's a really great question. It's made me much more aware of people and their vulnerabilities. It's made me much more aware that society needs to be more open-minded and receptive to other opportunities and other platforms to help people. And I don't feel that's opening up fast enough so that we can start saving lives. So I have a high level of frustration, more than I ever have, because I wrote the book to save lives. I wrote the book in hope that people would read the book and the book would last with them for a long time. And I've had people who bought my book when it first came out in 2016, who I've come across subsequently years later, and they're telling me they still remember the book. They've reread it several times. It's a book that sticks to your ribs.
Is there someone recently that you've connected with that you want to share with us?
I always have interesting stories. I have a lot of, most of my clientele are female. Most of them are moms. So I have a lot of mothers coming, talking, wanting to talk to their children. I just had a mom come whose son, which is, by the way, very common for a child to be addictive to drugs. It's usually one of the prerequisite or precursors to adolescent suicides. There's usually a very strong drug connection. And she didn't know he was doing drugs. He kept the secret really well. So that's another aspect of awareness that I want to bring to the table is, don't let your children answer the questions that you've asked them in a very general way. Be very specific. Spend the time. Dig in your heels and really talk to your children. And I know a lot of parents say that they do, but I have an awful lot of parents who I'm sure said that they did and then have realized they really didn't. And it's not about judgment. It's not about bad parenting. This is what I want to get across. I think all too often parents worry about, am I a good parent? Am I a bad parent? What's society going to think? I want parents not to give a crap, if I can say that on air. I want you to pay more attention to your children and not care what anybody else thinks. If you need to really sit down and dig in and dig into your child's life, then do it. Whatever society thinks is acceptable is not relevant to how you raise your child. Every child, every person has a different set of needs, a different set of requirements, has different gifts from the other side. That's when I do readings and I talk to, I just had another young man come in who has attempted suicide twice. He found my book, made an appointment. He's 27 years old and he's lost, completely lost. And his mother, from when the reading, was a really great mom. She did everything that she could. She didn't do anything wrong. It's, unfortunately, there is a huge deficit between functionality and enabling.
You mentioned that most of your clients are women. I'm a very emotional guy, and sometimes I don't feel that most men are. Is that one of the reasons why women, because they're more spiritual, they're more emotional, they're more loving? Why would most of your clients be women?
All of that, plus women are nurturing. They are more giving. They're more open and receptive because of the way they think, the way we interact. Men are very much more right-brained, very definitive, don't like change as a general rule. So they are my biggest skeptics sometimes. As a matter of fact, I just had an open forum gallery reading Friday night, and there were four men that came. They came with their wives and grouping of friends. And I actually picked out each individual man, and they were scattered throughout the room. And I had one of them stand up. He was actually in his early 30s. He came kicking and screaming. Now, I don't know any of this up until I start the reading. I asked him to stand up. He said his name. And the first thing I said to him is, you came kicking and screaming. You think this is a bunch of hokum and it's all smoke and mirrors. And you just came so that at the end of the night, you can make fun of your girlfriend. You can make fun of her family because you will have been proved right. And then I proceeded to deliver only specific information he knew about from his grandfather. By the time he left the event, not only was he crying, he was on the phone telling his family, and they were confirming information that he wasn't aware of.
How many people are like you, do you think?
There's a lot of people awakening to the inner journey, their consciousness, their spiritual connectivity, psychic awareness. At my experience level, very few.
How about religious leaders from all different faiths? How do they look at you?
You know, I think it's really a question of individual journey. Religion plays a part, but I truly believe it's the experiences and the lessons that form the people. So part of that is cultural. Part of that is personal experience. Part of that is religion. I've had certain priests, certain ministers be very open and receptive, and I've had others that have not. And I think really it comes down to the inner belief structure of each individual and what they've witnessed and what they've had in their lives.
You talked about life contracts throughout your book and even during this interview. Do you have any idea what your life contract will be in the next 10 years? What's in store for Teresa St. Francis?
You know, I don't get for myself. I get for everybody else. And that is the norm for a true spiritual medium, is somebody who comes into my office. I can give you the game plan. I can talk about past, present, future, career, health, money, relationships, those around you, life contracts, those on the other side, which I specialize in, including pets. But as far as myself, I don't get a darn thing other than, buckle up, buttercup, here we go.
Do you think the pets thing is where most people become skeptical?
I think there's a lot more skeptics who don't want to believe that somebody can actually talk to an animal and receive information and channel that information in a dialogue. And domestic animals are far more versed in conversation than you could ever imagine.
So you have a couple of pets.
I have two dogs.
Do you talk to them? Can you get messages from them?
Oh, I do. Wizard is my half-Siberian Husky, half-standard Poodle. If you go to my website, www.teresastfrancis.com, you'll see pictures of Wizard and Halo. They talk all the time. We talk telepathically. We talk verbally. 9 o'clock at night, if you're at my house, Wizard starts talking up Husky talk, because he's half-Siberian Husky, half-standard Poodle. And we have a conversation for about 20 minutes, and he's all physically vocal with me. And then the rest of the day, he's usually very telepathic with me. He'll come and nudge me, and he'll make sure that I look in his eyes, and we have this connection. He'll tell me he's got to go to the bathroom, he's hungry, there's no more water in the bowl, he's unhappy because I'm working too much, he hasn't gotten enough belly time.
We're speaking with internationally renowned spiritual messenger and author Teresa St. Francis, whose book, What Happens the Day After, Messages from Adolescent Suicides, came out in 2016. And has caught the attention of many. I want to pass something along to you because it's something that always it touches me. I mentioned this to my class just this semester. I said, have you met somebody for the first time, and by the end of the evening, you hug? because there is a connection between the two. And I'm not talking a sexual, I'm not talking a connection of the, is that how that starts? I mean, is that another a way that we know that spirits are working? Like in one case, I felt the presence of an old friend through somebody else. During a card game, he had the same response, same mannerisms, to a point where we hugged at the end of the night, and I felt like I was hugging my old friend, or actually my father's best friend.
Absolutely. Spirit has this great way of using all of us in our daily lives to send messages to other people, as well as animals, smells, signs in your house, noises, numbers. There's a lot of synchronicity. The universe is constantly interacting with us to let us know they're there, they love us, and they're there to help. And they do it in many different ways. I'll share one with you. My birthday is in October, and I got up on my birthday, and Spirit wanted to wish me happy birthday, so they said to me, turn on the TV. And I turned on the TV, and as soon as I turned on the TV, there was a movie, and as I turned on the TV, the movie was on, and they were singing happy birthday, and they had just lit the birthday candles in the movie.
See, this is where you start to scare me.
That was their way of saying to me, happy birthday.
Amazing. I know that you can't talk about some of the things you have come up specifically until some contracts are signed, but if people want to find out more about Teresa St. Francis, what can they do?
They can go to my website, TeresaSt.Francis.com. Also, check out my social media platform on Facebook, Teresa St. Francis. They can also call the office at 201-475-1044 to book an appointment, a house party.
We've heard about the college admission scandal, and even people who have money to pay for school are still feeling like they need to do certain things in order to get their kids where they want to be. You've talked about it in the book. You've talked about how the competition level that it is for kids these days to succeed, whether it be from little up, is dramatic right now.
It's scary dramatic, and it's not getting any better. And the message I wanted to relay in the book is it doesn't matter how great your kid is, whether they're number one or two. It matters how they see themselves. It matters that we support them in a way that they can flourish and they can thrive versus this constant competition where you have to be number one. You have to be the best. You got to get to the best colleges. You got to get into the best teams. You got to make that A on your exam. You got to take that test. The pressure to succeed and be number one from a society standpoint is actually a self-destructive mode and paradigm that's causing these kids to crack and crumble.
Tell us about some of the other jobs that you had. You did not choose this to be your career that it's turned out to be for more than three decades.
No, I did not choose it. Spirit chose me. I worked in Wall Street. I started my way up out of college. I worked in sales. And then I worked my way up to a vice president of telecommunications. And I was in sales. I was in management, upper management. I've owned a few businesses along the way, art businesses, creative businesses. This was not my first choice. This was Spirit's choice. They kind of grabbed me by the neck one day and got me into a car accident in the early 80s, and I was not supposed to be able to walk. That was Spirit's way of slowing me down and stopping from working in the city to healing, and that was my first introduction to being a healer. I had to learn how to self-heal. And today I can walk. The prognosis at the time from the accident was I wasn't going to be able to walk again, especially in high heels, or even walk a straight line, because I had pulled every ligament and muscle from my ankle all the way up into my neck in the car accident. This was Spirit's way of saying, you need to stop and listen to us. So I've done quite a few things in my life, so I have a very strong background. I've worked on horse farms. I've worked on dairy farms. As I said, I was a pre-vet major, so I wanted to be a large animal livestock. That was really my passion. Spirit had other things in mind.
Being someone who can connect to, you know, the other side, did that ever help you on Wall Street?
You know, no. Spirit wasn't really interested in making sure that that worked for me. There was one roadblock after another that I should have paid a little bit more attention to. But when Spirit got a hold of me, it was only after my apartment was haunted that I was introduced to, this is what you're supposed to do. From that point until I had the car accident, it was about a year. And every night they come in when I was meditating and they tell me, you know, you need to do this professionally. We want you to lecture. And there were no role models back then. This was not accepted in society the way it is today. Or it wasn't even something that society really knew about. And Spirit kept saying, you need to do this. So they won. I've been doing this for over 30 years and I love what I do. But this story of how I got here is a very long, intensive journey.
I asked you in the early part of the interview about those who claim to be able to do what you can do. Do you ever point them out to people and say this person is not who he or she says they are?
No. I don't like that aspect of humanity. It's not my job. It's not within my nature to point negativity out. My nature is to be positive and uplifting. If somebody asks my opinion, I will say to them, everybody has a different opinion because everybody's got their own reality. You should experience it for yourself and make your own decision.
We appreciate you joining us on the WBGO Journal.
Thank you so much for having me, Doug. It's been an honor and a pleasure.